Buck Rising just had his head shaved on air. Clay Travis joining us right now. It's presented by The Home Loan Expert. TheHomeLoanExpert.com is the website. Clay, we just shaved a guy's head on air to settle a bet. And that
you
sound
can hear
here
the
right
vacuum
now,
of the hair.
Yeah, this is the our backing How's track that? Right now is Chelsea, the stylist, with the vacuum picking up the hair.
It's top flight ambient sound.
Clay, what would it take? You love your hair. What would it take for you to shave your head?
I think I shaved it once. I lost a bet with your old friend Aaron Andrews back in the day. I bet that John Gruden was going to be the head coach of Tennessee, and obviously I was wrong. And I shaved my head. Not in shave it. Like, I mean, and then we got into a debate about what constitutes a shaving. I got it all the way down to a buzz, right? Like, and I considered that to be a shaving. I didn't, like, get a, you know, like a
straight razor cream
and go full bald, you know, like Mr. Clean look. But I think you go all the way down to a buzz, that's shaving.
Yeah, we went with no guard on the Clippers. And didn't go like straight razor, but there's scalp. I mean, there is visible scalp on Buck's head right now. So I would constitute that as a shaving. And that was similar to what you had, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was fine with it. Look, my hair is spectacular, but it grows back fast. So my life's not that much different if it's short for a while.
So, Clay, what do you think about everything that went on with the city of Nashville, with Mayor John Cooper, with John Ingram? John Ingram makes these concessions. He's spending a lot more money. The city's off the hook for that. But in doing this, it opens the door for the possibility of an expanded plaza that would connect with an improved racetrack. But the racetrack probably wouldn't be the same sweetheart deal for the city, and the city would have to pay. If you're John Ingram in this, are you upset? Are you mad that you almost feel like the sucker that had to pay everything while NASCAR comes in? How do you think all this worked out, and is this what ultimately is best for the city of Nashville?
Well, I don't presume to know all the details, so I think saying what's best for the city of Nashville is tough, other than to say I think what I said last week, which is I would like to have a big-time soccer venue and a team that's able to play there for a substantial number of dates, and I would like to have a big NASCAR event in the city, too, and I say that as not a guy who's a proponent of NASCAR. So I think what's best for the city is that Nashville get as many big-time sporting events as we possibly can. And it seems like this agreement that has been reached makes that more rather than less likely, which I think means that it's a good result for the city overall. And by the way, I think that John, I can't pretend to speak for other people, but I think that most of the people who are fans of NASCAR and most of the people who are fans of soccer would agree with that statement in general, that even if you're not a big fan of either of those sports, it's better for the city's overall sports resume and reputation to have as many big events as possible, because the more big events you have, the more big events you're going to get. And if you live here, that's a pretty great opportunity to have to be able to go see them.
It turned out well. We don't know what's going to happen with the racing part of it, obviously. But what do you think of the mayor kind of making MLS seemingly jump through hoops for a deal that was already done? It seemed untoward to us, considering that it was a done deal. He inherited what was a done deal and then seemingly tried to kind of to reopen it in a way that didn't appear to be, quote unquote, fair to the party that had done everything it already needed to do.
Well, I think beyond this particular deal, it's a bad precedent when city government attempts to remake or redo deals that they have already reached with businesses, regardless of what those businesses are. When the businesses are in the business of relying on the representations that have been given to them by the city government or the state government or anywhere else, because business is reliant upon being able to predict, right? I mean, you set your budget and plan based on being able to rely on the promises and covenants and contractual relationships that you've entered into with the city or state government. When that doesn't happen, it's a bad sign, right? I mean, that's what happens in banana republics where, you know, somebody new comes in and says, oh, no, we can't do this anymore, and makes it more difficult for business instead of being welcoming for business. It's a balancing act in general, right? You don't want to give away what makes your city and state great in order to be able to attain business. But simultaneously, the reason why most of us have the lifestyles that we have in America today is because of capitalism, and capitalism relies upon contractual agreements being ratified, verified, and enforced by our courts.
Clay, you grew up playing soccer. You know the sport well. And I hear this, and I understand that soccer in Nashville is a good thing, and that soccer as a sport is growing in the United States. But I think we need to contextualize the difference between just soccer here is going to be big, and it's growing faster, and there's more people playing, and there's more people interested in, let's say, NASCAR, from MLS and what MLS soccer in Nashville means, because you're not getting the top of the top in terms of globally here, but it is the best league in the United States. So when you hear MLS in Nashville, is it a slam dunk no-brainer it's going to work? And what do you think about that correlation when people just talk about, in general, soccer in this city and having to separate that from what MLS is?
Well, it's not like that Nashville is in the business to get an EPL team, right? So
right.
It's not like, oh, you know, you Nashville was going to get an EPL team, and instead we got an MLS team. So far as I know, for my life, the best range of professional sports that will ever exist in the soccer universe in the United States and also in soccer in general is going to be the MLS. So I think the question becomes, can MLS continue to grow to such an extent that the overall quality of the league continues to increase, and such that the stars eventually are not guys who have basically passed their prime and are finishing out their careers here because they love America, and instead can it become a big enough sport in the 20 years, 40 years into the future where you start to compete for some of the best players around the world? I think that's reasonable to believe that in 20 to 40 years, the MLS can sometimes have the best players in the world. You know, if there are 100 best players of soccer in the world, I don't think it's crazy to think that 25 of them could be MLS players. You know, and based on the sheer size of the United States economy and the growth rate of our country and the growth of soccer here. So I think it's a long-range play, and I think if you talk to the ownership group, and I have a couple of at least one really good friend who's a part of the ownership group, and we've had that conversation. And he has said, look, this is not, you know, a 2020 play. It's a 2030 play and a 2040 play and a 2050 play. And also, it's not just a play about soccer. It's a play about Nashville, that you want to be not only in a sport that's growing, but in a city where it's growing and dynamic as well. And I tend to think that there's a big audience for soccer that will respond well over time to MLS. I'm not sure what it's going to be, I think, on February 29th when they debut. And I'm not sure what it's going to be, you know, in 2024. But I think in 2035, it'll do well. You know, I mean, when exactly it's going to take off, I don't claim to know.
Is there anything too big for Nashville right now? Because now that this is happening, a combo that with possibly NASCAR events coming here, improved Speedway, there's now going to be talk about Major League Baseball. And Rob Manfred's already mentioned Nashville as a possible destination. The Super Bowl is not going to happen without a new stadium, but in terms of city infrastructure, could that be feasible? Just when you look at this city right now and where it's going, is there anything you're just saying no to and would say, nope, Nashville's not ready for that?
No. I mean, I think you could make an argument that Nashville can't do anything. I mean, I think you could say Nashville could have a Super Bowl in 2035.
What about the Olympics?
Well, the Olympics I would say no to. And I don't even think, by the way, we would want the Olympics.
No.
Right?
I mean,
that's the one I would say no to.
Logistically impossible.
Too big for Nashville.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't even want it. Like, that's not even, I guess, yes.
You don't want to build a velodrome.
I would say no to. But I think we could host a World Cup game. You know, I don't know if we'll make that cut, but I think that it would sell out, and I think people would respond to it in a very favorable way. I think we could host the Final Four. You know, I think we could certainly host one of the college football playoff games or the college football title game if we had somebody who was willing to spend the money to build a retractable roof style dome or something like that. Here's what I would say in general. Nashville is most missing. It is super rich people. I think for a city of our size, we don't have the same corporate base that other cities do. And, you know, it can only take one taking off. You know, if instead of going to Harvard, Mark Zuckerberg had been at Vanderbilt, and by the way, that's not a crazy proposition, and a company like Facebook had grown up associated with Vanderbilt as opposed to Harvard and Stanford, then I think all of the other companies that follow it in would be massive, right? I mean, that's like the advantage which I think exists in Silicon Valley, is all of those companies that have been founded out there, they have the big corporate dollars to support major, major levels of success. I think some of those companies are growing, but I don't know that we have, if you put, say, Nashville on a list and compared it with Atlanta or you know, some of the other cities, that Charlotte even, that you would want to compare the city with. I think that's probably where we're lacking the most.
No, you're not a baseball guy, but I presume you are a scandal guy. The scope of what the Astros did, pretty severe. No matter what anybody else was doing, there's a lot of evidence here. There's not a lot of evidence anywhere else. PR handling of it yesterday was just pitiful. And they give away immunity here so that the people executing it didn't really get punished. I'm just curious your overall take on how baseball handled this, how the Astros handled it, and if you think there's any more resolution to be had.
Yeah, I thought the PR aspect of this was a disaster. And I think it's what's so surprising to me is how bad people are at PR. I really do think that in another life, I should have just been like a crisis PR guy, because I genuinely love all these scandals and the way you respond to them. And this is not that hard of a question to me. You know, if I'm running Astros management response to this, what I sit down and lecture everybody with is, look, the angle that we should adopt here, and I think this is true. I'm actually reading a book about Babe Ruth right now. And it's fascinating, like some of the things that used to exist in baseball where cheating has been endemic, despite the fact that we talk now like, oh my God, steroids. Like, did you know that in baseball, they outlawed the spitball, but they allowed everybody who had continued to do the spitball to spit it, to do the spitball until their career was over. They grandfathered them in, which is pretty crazy. It's an amazing story. So if you were already in the major leagues and your primary pitch was the spitball, they allowed you to continue to do it until you were finished, while outlawing it for everybody else who was coming into the league new, which I've never even heard of before. It's an amazing, like, kind of compromise. But stealing signals has been something that has gone on in baseball for generations and still goes on today. I think if what the Astros should have done is say, we took a part of the game which is known and accepted and considered to be a competitive aspect of the business, and we wedded it with modern-day technology such that it was unacceptable. And for that, our own attempts to win games led us to break the rules. We deserve all the punishments that we received. It's why we fired our manager. It's why we fired our general manager. Ultimately, the blame lies with the directors and leaders of the team and the program. We will never do anything like this again. I apologize. I understand why everybody in baseball is furious with us. I don't blame them. If I were a Yankee or a Dodger fan, I would be furious at us too. And I hope that for the remainder of my tenure as an owner of this team, that we never do anything to jeopardize our relationship with baseball and its fans. Boom! I just did that off the cuff right now. And I think everybody out there listening would say, man, I still hate the Astros, but the guy owned it, he acknowledged it, and this thing is now in the past, and we have to figure out how to deal with it to ensure that it doesn't happen again. The fact that you go out there and are unable to even utter a statement like that and are so ham-handed and, frankly, arrogant and dumb in the way that you handle it is mind-boggling to me, and it makes me even more angry if I'm a baseball fan about the process.
Well, and Clay, you know this, but what you just did was a great off-the-cuff statement, and you have the ability to do that. The owner of the Astros, just because he's a billionaire, doesn't mean that he has the ability to answer questions.
And if you can't, and look, I
then you don't put him in front of the media, I guess, is the answer, right?
You write that in a statement. You say, hey, you know what? We've decided not to respond to questions. I'll come out and I'll read a statement if you want to see me face-to-face. And then even say, like, look, I'm not professional at answering questions. You know, people have talents in different areas. I feel awful about what happened. I don't want to try to get responding to questions because I think I'll do a bad job of it, and I don't think I'll represent our team well. It's not something that I do well, right? And maybe, I mean, I've thought this for a while. I think it would be funny, you know, like we don't really have the press briefings anymore, but sometimes coaches are bad at it. And I sometimes think, like, if every coach had a press secretary who was in charge of answering questions like the president's supposed to, you know, like Jeremy Pruitt, sometimes I hear him talk and I'm like, man, this guy is such a redneck. He doesn't necessarily do himself very good. And Butch Jones was obviously atrocious at it. Nick Saban, I think, on the other hand, is pretty good. But if you were bad at it, what if you could just deputize a guy or girl who was responsible to answer questions for the media and would do a much better job of it than you would. I sometimes think sports figures would be better off if they had that too.
So, Clay, the Pac-12, how much trouble is that conference in when you look around and see the level of coach now that's in the conference in college football? Mel Tucker, Michigan State couldn't get the coach from Cincinnati, but they could go into the Pac-12 and get Colorado's coach. Is that more of a statement about Colorado, or is there so many issues now with the Pac-12 and the way that conference is run that it's really a conference issue?
It's a money issue. The Big Ten and the SEC are going to be the rich guys in the neighborhood, and the rich guys in the neighborhood have better cars and better houses than the poor guys in the neighborhood do. And so that's effectively what we're at. The SEC network and the Big Ten network throw off gobs of cash. The deal that the Big Ten has with Fox and ESPN for its premier rights, the new one that the SEC has negotiated with ESPN, is going to produce a cavalcade of money, a waterfall of cash, which they are going to be able to distribute to hire the best coaching talent and probably, frankly, to buy the best players, right? And so as a result, they're going to be better. And so I think this is a competitive issue where the Pac-12 lost them because of the money. I think it was totally a money issue. And the Big Ten and the SEC are going to have the ability to offer salaries that, frankly, the Pac-12, the ACC, and the Big 12 as a group are not. Now, individual schools, Texas and Oklahoma may be able to compete, right? USC may be able to compete. Clemson, when they're rolling, Florida State, maybe they can compete. There's like five or six schools outside of the Big Ten and the SEC who all have those schools that'll be able to compete. And I think it's a major issue going forward.
How much of it is a cultural issue? Obviously, finances have a lot to do with it. But, for example, there are certain schools and fan bases that will brag about how much they're paying their head football coach. Texas A&M is an example that pops to mind. They love that they're paying Jimbo Fisher that much money. You pay a Pac-12 coach that much money, and it's a source of people criticizing the school and the program for doing that.
It's a function of the budget, right? I mean, ultimately, if you can afford to pay Jimbo Fisher $7.5 million a year, they blew the budget that Florida State could pay out of the water, basically, right? And Florida State is a very successful ACC school. Like, Boston College could not pay $7.5 million. Neither could Syracuse. I'm not trying to pick on those schools. It's just their overall budgets are a fraction of the budget that's going to be being produced by the SEC and the Big Ten schools. And the thing that stands out here is it's Michigan State. You know, we're not talking about Michigan doing this or Ohio State doing this or even, frankly, Penn State. We're talking about Michigan State, which might be what, sixth or seventh best job in the Big Ten? I mean, if we're being honest, you can certainly argue about where exactly it ranks, but it's behind Michigan. It's behind Ohio State. It's behind Penn State. Maybe it's behind Wisconsin. Maybe it's behind Nebraska. Maybe it's behind, I'm just running through right now off the top of my head, right? You can argue about
maybe it's behind Iowa. I mean, that's another one you can put up there.
Behind Iowa, right? I mean, like, the point is Michigan State is not Alabama, and it's not Michigan, and it's not like one of these programs that produces so much cash, or even Tennessee, which is top 10 in producing cash. And I think that's a challenge going forward.
Clay Travis, he joins us every week, every Friday at 11 a.m., presented by the Home Loan Expert. Clay, thanks as always, man. Really appreciate
it. By the way, I got one for you, a good topic here that I was just writing as you called me. Ranking the holidays, that it's Valentine's Day. Here's my top 10. You guys can debate it as you come back really fast. In order, Christmas, Halloween, July 4th, New Year's Eve, Thanksgiving, Cinco de Mayo, maybe a little bit aggressive to consider it, St. Patrick's Day, Memorial Day, Labor Day, 10th, Valentine's Day. Now, I excluded Veterans Day, President's Day, Columbus Day, MLK Day, and Easter because there may be holidays, but they either have a direct religious connection or, like, I don't know a lot of people who are like, man, you know what the best day of the year is? Columbus Day. I just have a President's Day. It's impossible.
Arbor Day.
Arbor Day.
What was between Labor Day and Valentine's Day?
I have Labor Day because it's a huge college.
No, after Labor Day and before Valentine's Day, I missed it.
I got Labor Day 9, Memorial Day 8, St. Patrick's Day 7, Cinco de Mayo 6. I got Valentine's Day 10.
It's a good discussion. No consideration of Earth Day in there in your top 10.
That's a good one too. Earth Day. Like, I understand there's some people who are like, hey, I love Earth more than you, but I don't. I mean, I'm not a guy who's like, man, this is the. I want to go fly a kite. This
well, it's also a Saturday. There's nothing off related about it.
Paul, just
or no drinking related.
Clay,
to it.
just out of curiosity, how many people got on you on Twitter for excluding MLK Day?
I haven't even published it yet. But I mean, I feel like it's fair. Like,
it's coming. Like it's get ready. That's going to be the first response from a lot of people.
I mean, I'm excluding President's Day. Like, I love Abraham Lincoln and George Washington more than anybody. But I don't think there's a lot of people out there that are like, man, I love, you know, like, there's nothing better than a nice President's Day. Right? Like, nobody's top 10.
No, this year we have it off. We're way up on President's Day. It's an arrow up.
I think you're also.
I get that day off. I mean, I love it. That now, it might change if the NFL. That does this new CBA and President's Day becomes Super Bowl the day after Super Bowl
Monday.
Yeah, then it's like a big celebration. But like, I'm trying to think of things where people have parties or you go to events and like it's pretty outstanding or there's big family events. But I don't think there's a lot of like, hey, we're going to do the whole family get together for Veterans Day, President's Day, Columbus Day, MLK Day. And again, I excluded Easter because. Not everybody, and people are like, well, Christmas is a religious holiday, but I mean, there's a lot of people who aren't religious at all that celebrate Christmas. I think there's a secular element to Christmas as well. So that's my top 10.
There is. Good luck with that,
Clay. Thanks.
All right. See y'all.